KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Patterson, California.
I live in Richmond.
Noe Valley.
San Francisco, Outer Mission.
Coming up, we'll hear about a hotline to help immigrants approached by immigration and customs enforcement officers.
If we don't know about the deportations in real time, they're going to be disappeared.
Then New America Media's executive director, Sandy Close, tells us why the organization that champions ethnic journalism is shutting down.
I do think if I had been more nimble, maybe we would have pulled it out.
And a story from the stoop about what some African immigrants find when they come to America.
Where is that job that you made a lot of money? Especially when the check comes in and you're like, what is this?
That's all coming up next here on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The Catholic Diocese in San Francisco is pushing hard to address the needs of undocumented immigrants. Two parishes have said they will offer sanctuary. Other organizations associated with the diocese, like Faith in Action, are informing immigrants about their constitutional rights. And there's another effort underway, a phone number that people can call should immigration officers show up in their neighborhoods, home, or work. Getting the hotline started was a collaboration between nonprofits and the San Francisco Archdiocese, and it was funded by the City of San Francisco. KALW's Judy Silber reported on that in March when the program was just getting started. Here's what she found.
Veníamos de Sacramento y veníamos pensando en cómo sería.
The idea came to Violeta Roman on her way to a Sacramento meeting of immigration advocates. Roman is a San Francisco resident, originally from Mexico, also an organizer. She was sitting in the car, thinking about the very real threat of deportation, when she suddenly blurted out, "What if there were an emergency hotline?"
Yo les decía como si fuera una línea del 911.
Something like 911 that you could use if ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement arm of Homeland Security, showed up at your door.
And we laughed, and then we're like, "Huh? How do you make that happen?"
Lorena Melgarejo works for the San Francisco Catholic Archdiocese, coordinating help for the immigrant community. She was Roman's companion in the car that day. Violeta Roman's vision was guided by personal experience. 2.5 years ago, at 5 a.m, ICE agents came to her house. They were looking for her father. Roman is Catholic, and she turned to the church for help. Her priest introduced her to Melgarejo. She helped find a lawyer. Church members went to court with her father. They listened to her.
Es cargar la cruz, pero no llevarla sola.
She said she's had to carry the cross, but not alone. Her father eventually gave up fighting his case and returned to Mexico. Even so, Roman feels lucky. She knows that not everyone has access to that kind of support, which is where the hotline idea came in. Turns out Melgarejo, who was there in the car, was just the person who could make it happen.
This reality of regular everyday people being targeted by immigration is not something that just started.
Still, she says it's a different era. After Trump's election and executive orders, the threat is higher. In San Francisco, a collaboration of nonprofits called the Immigration Legal and Education Network had already begun putting together a hotline. It connected undocumented immigrants who had been arrested by ICE with legal help. Roman and Melgarejo decided to team up with them. The nonprofits had lawyers and city government funds to pay for the hotline. The Archdiocese and its partners could help spread the word. They also began recruiting volunteers who would provide support for families and witnesses who would physically be there as ICE made its arrests.
God of all people, stir us to holy anger over the wounds of our world.
On a rainy weekday evening, about 60 people are gathered in the vast, echoey cathedral of St. Agnes Church in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury neighborhood. They're here for a volunteer training. Some are church members, others not. From a podium, Melgarejo asks how many people know someone who was deported in the past 8 years. Only a few hands go up. Then she tells them about the hotline and how the volunteer part will work. After someone calls, volunteers will go to where that person is, their home or place of work. First, they'll verify that it's not a false alarm. If they arrive after an arrest, they'll connect with the detainee's family. If ICE is still there, they'll turn into observers and videotape. Not to interfere with what's happening, but the videotapes can be used as evidence in immigration court, if necessary.
I think initially it feels scary, but I think really it's just about being there and observing.
Monica Floyd has come tonight to volunteer. She says she grew up in Oakland where some of her friends' parents lacked papers.
So I've had a few friends actually whose parents have been detained and one friend whose parents, their father was deported.
In San Francisco, Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone is taking a proactive stance. That includes backing churches that want to be a sanctuary space and also other types of support. Sunday Mass is ending at the Cathedral of St. Mary of the Assumption, high on a hill in San Francisco's Western Addition. But today, many of the Latino congregants will not go home. Instead, they're heading downstairs for a workshop to learn about their constitutional rights. More than 200 people have crowded into the space, which is standing room only in the back. The priest, Father Arturo Albano, begins to speak.
Muy buenas tardes a todos. Soy Padre Arturo Albano, de sangre filipino, sí.
He tells the crowd while he is Filipino by blood,
pero de corazón latino.
His heart is Latino. And he has a dog from Juarez, Mexico.
Es indocumentado.
He jokes, the dog is undocumented. And now President Trump wants to arrest him.
La pregunta es esta.
An older man in the front row stands up.
¿Hay algún personal que esté listo?
He wants to know, if ICE knocks, is there someone from the Mexican consulate who will support him with legal help? Lorena Malgarejo points to a poster behind her. In large print is a number, 415-200-1548. It's the hotline, also called the San Francisco Rapid Response Network. It's been live since mid-February, and since early March, volunteers are also now responding to the calls. The older man's name is Francisco. He didn't want us to use his last name because of fears about his immigration status. He's originally from Mexico, but has lived in the United States for 17 years.
Francamente, lo que sentimos es temor.
The truth of what the undocumented community feels is terror. But after the meeting, he says he feels different.
Me siento diferente, es decir, me siento alegre por la reunión que hemos tenido.
Happy for the meeting that they've had. In a place like this, he's among friends. That's also what Violeta Roman felt when she got support after her father was detained. Now her dream of the hotline promises to help others also feel less alone. Lorena Malgarejo says it's important for the church to take an active role. In her mind, this is a spiritual crisis.
I mean, for me as a person of faith, I'm talking about something that seems immoral.
San Francisco is the first county in the Bay Area to organize a hotline like this, but Malgarejo says it won't be the last. In San Francisco, I'm Judy Silber for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in March. Lorena Malgarejo is now Executive Director of Faith in Action, which continues to work closely with the San Francisco Archdiocese. Also, there are now many more rapid response hotlines around the Bay Area, including Santa Clara, San Mateo, Marin, Sonoma, and Napa counties. Find all that information at KELW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hanat Baba. One of the greatest amplifiers of ethnic news in the United States is shutting down at the end of the month. It's New America Media, whose mission has been to, quote, bring the voices of the marginalized into the national discourse, end quote. NAM started out as Pacific News Service back in 1969. Since then, it's partnered with more than 700 hyphenated American news organizations, and KALW has a very special relationship with NAM. Journalists, including KALW's Sandeep Roy, our alumni and members of our news staff, including myself, have taken part in NAM's journalism fellowships. In fact, my first news article ever was published by Pacific News Service. Needless to say, we here at KALW feel a deep sadness with the closure of NAM. So we invited Sandy Close, the director of the organization since 1974, to our studios to talk about why it's shutting down and what's next. Let's ask that first question. Why is New America Media shutting down?
I think the best way to answer that is that we couldn't match our operating costs with the revenue we were bringing in. When you take risks, as we took, and I have to personalize this since I've been the director for so many years. I've been a risk taker. So we'd plunge. We started multilingual polling. We started programs in juvenile hall. We really loved the idea that really I inherited from Pacific News Service's early years, 1970 to 74, the idea that you could report on the U.S. role in Indochina, not through the conventional reporting methods, but go to the GI who had witnessed fragging, go to the expert who understood what the impact of the air war on Laos or Agent Orange could be. Use unconventional sources because you knew there was more to the story. That may sound sort of old hat now, but in those years it was pretty unusual, pretty radical. And taking that idea and applying it to all of the new landscapes that were evolving in the United States from the mid-70s on, the impact of unprecedented immigration, the development of the computer revolution, the death of American cities that we saw in very different terms because we were looking at things 2 feet off the ground. Mm-hmm. What we were seeing was the rebirth of American cities. And then, of course, if there's a generation of violent young people labeled super predators, well, let's go out and hear from them, not to prove that they're somehow bad kids destined for failure, but to understand that there are kids. We need to hear their voice. This notion of turning one group into the bad guy and one group into the good guy as if we're the arbiters of that. No, we're implicated in it. Let's find those stories. So when you say that Pacific News Service is ending and New America Media is ending, I say it isn't as long as you're at that microphone looking for more people to expand the lens.
I wanted to ask you about sustainability. So in public media, the nonprofit world, we're having this conversation that doesn't seem to go away about sustainability and what business models work. How can we stick to our values as public media and still be sustainable? Or is it a time for different thinking?
I can only share what our experience was, because I think had we not accumulated the debts, we had found a way to sustain our core operations. And what the root of that was really is combining journalism with social marketing. Social marketing is essentially a fancy way of saying what we used to say around community organizing. Mm. In fact, there's a kind of depressing trend that you see public relations firms sort of replacing community organizers because they're skilled at social media or they're skilled at advertising. There's nothing that will substitute for a high-touch communication, nothing that really can take away the ability, for example, to convene communities, to bring people together. And that's something I think public radio also has. The challenge is to find a way to both do justice to the journalism and also find ways that allow you to monetize your ability to raise awareness about those issues. All of that makes me think entrepreneurially. Mm-hmm. And we were able to combine advertising, social marketing, through advertising, through community convenings, and through journalism in a way that I think could have sustained us had it not been for, you know, years of taking risks, acquiring debts, and not being able to pay them down quite fast enough.
But that's what we're told to do. We're told to be optimistic, take risks, do the job, make the media.
But
that's what we're told.
Yes, and I do think if I had been more nimble and had a better handle on managing the funds without being quite so determined and optimistic, maybe we would have pulled it out. But look, there are more people out there, and I think we found strategies that we'd like to share. The real challenge is to look at how can we take the lessons learned, the strategic approaches we developed, the relationships with the media sector that is such an inspiring sector to work with. How can we take those and move forward after NAM? Let New America Media and Pacific News Service rest in peace. Are there ways we can continue the work afterwards?
That's Sandy Close, Executive Director of New America Media. The organization is shutting down at the end of the month, but the spirit of its work will continue at outlets like KALW. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We're going to end today's show with an excerpt from the podcast The Stoop, hosted by myself and reporter Leela Day.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
The Stoop. The Stoop.
Stories about Black identity that aren't always shared in the open.
Shh, girl, we can't say that.
It's like a griot,
a hair salon,
a newsroom,
and your mama's kitchen all in one.
When people choose to migrate to the U.S., they have a certain fantasy of what America is like. And for many people, that image is fabulous. Endless, high-paying jobs. Everything is sparkling clean. There's no poverty. Then they arrive, and that image changes pretty fast. In our episode called Coming to America, we ask African immigrants what they wish they knew about the U.S. before they came here. We feature the immigration story of our very own Edwin Okongo, the Kenyan host of Africa Mix, right here on KALW. He said back home, they think of America as a heaven. His uncle was the first to come to the U.S., so Edwin remembers back in the 80s when he was a kid, when his uncle would come back to Kenya on vacations and tell the whole village about his life in America.
And people like in the village where we are from, they sat under this big sacred tree that we call Omotembe. And they sat down. This is where like they used to hold like the courts in a traditional, where we call ritongo, which was like traditional court, you know, which you are held in. So they sit down and he's telling them these stories about America and how things are, you know, everybody drives and you know where we come from, a car is a sign of wealth. And we're like, wow.
His uncle brought back T-shirts and shoes for everybody in the village.
It was this huge event.
And then he brought money. It was like, I wanna be able to do that. I wanna go to America. So he was talking about there's a machine you put, money gives you food.
Machine?
Ooh, I don't know what he's talking about. What is that machine? The food machine?
I don't know what machine he's talking about, but people started talking and everyone had their own version of this story. You know the grapevine and how that works.
Yes.
Like a game of telephone. And so by the time the story reached Edwin, I mean, his imagination just took off.
You imagine this conveyor belt, like you don't have to leave the office, you just press and it brings like a nice hot meal coming on a conveyor belt to your desk and all you have to do is eat, you know. So I came to find out that that was about a vending machine. Yeah, so we had all these misconceptions.
He was dreaming about America.
America.
A lot of us thought that it was going to be a huge city. Everything is developed. And there's no rural areas, no unpaved road, no poverty. So really, it was that like heaven. And I think a lot of immigrants have said that, you know, America is heaven.
Heaven, heaven, heaven.
So I landed in San Francisco. And my uncle comes to pick me up, and it was raining, you know, that January rain, and I've got in a car, and it's a flashy Toyota 4Runner Burgundy, and it's like driving down the highway, and I'm looking at all this nice building and the white highways, and this African music playing, you know, my favorite. And he had this guy, Alus Mabele, who I loved when I was in high school. And he's playing, and I'm like, man, heaven is good. And we're driving, we go down to Santa Clara, and I expected my uncle to be in a mansion. You know, you should mention. But we walk into this apartment complex and walk in there. Introduces me to like six people. And then, you know, they cook, we eat. And then it comes time to go to bed. And I find out that all those six people lived in this two-bedroom apartment. And I'm shown my corner, like, you're going to be sleeping there. And so-and-so is, you know, face your feet that way so they don't stink on his face. And it was just like, you know, waking up in that living room and really, the lines of the bathroom. And I was, like, so excited to have the shower things. Like, so I didn't know that, oh, you're not going to work. You have no business being in the shower at 7 a.m. You know, so there were a lot of like, hey, get out of here. You know, and I learned very early on that, wow, this is not what I signed up for. This is going to be tough.
So Edwin started applying for jobs since he needed to pay for school.
My first job was doing dishes at a school and working at Wendy's.
He worked long hours, making less than $5 an hour.
And he did that for a few months.
And there are actually some times I was feigning sickness to get out of that job. Because I was, this is hard. When I look at where is that job that I thought that you made a lot of money, especially when the check comes in and you're like, what is this? You know, it is. If I made this money in Kenya, I'll be like the equivalent of a lawyer, doctor. But here, it is.
That's the one thing he says he wishes he would have known about.
Mm-hmm. That it's not easy money, right?
Yeah, not at all.
And nobody talks about the poverty that is here and how hard and the loans that a lot of these people are taking to go back home, you know. So that's why we were like, it's heaven. So people like my uncle, you know, God bless him, I love him, but he knows I talk about this. Like, you guys really did us a disservice in not saying that you were working really hard. You were doing things that you, a lot of us, that we have done that we would not want to talk about to make that money to help our families.
So now what do you tell people in Kenya who want to come to the United States?
I tell them the truth. I tell them that this place is tough. I tell them that if you have a job in Kenya, you have a good job, you've been to a university, you have no business being in the United States.
That was an excerpt from the podcast The Stoop, featuring myself and Leela Day. The Stoop's radio home is right here at KALW. You can hear that entire episode called Coming to America with lots more African voices from around the Bay, and subscribe to the show at thestoop.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Atemu Atan, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Amber Miles, Lisa Morehouse, Christine Nguyen, Stephen Short, Andrew Stelzer, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Gabe Graben, James Rollins, and Jackie Sajiko. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.